It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Communities around the state, they're learning how the new shared revenue formula will affect local services. We hear reactions on the ground from a roundtable of city leaders, and you can join in to discuss additional aid flowing from the state and what it will be used for. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Hirsch is Eau Claire City Manager. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. And we have Anthony Penterman, Mayor of Kaukauna. Anthony, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. And Mark Roloff is here, Oshkosh City Manager. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Mark, let's start with you. How significant is the additional state funding that Oshkosh will receive?
Well, I think it's significant for all municipalities, certainly for the city of Oshkosh. While we are on the low end on the percentage side of 20%, it means about a $1.9 million increase in revenue for the city of Oshkosh. So that's certainly significant in being able to provide the basic services that for the last 30 years we've been getting cut very slowly but consistently over that 30 years. So essentially we're back to 1992 in terms of what we're getting from the state, but it's certainly a better situation than what we've been experiencing.
All right, back to 1992. Stephanie, from your perspective in Eau Claire, correct me with these numbers, expecting $1.2 million more, but that's less than 1% of the city budget. What do you make of this additional funding?
That's right. So we are, in general, really happy that the process happened and that many communities are benefiting, but the change has really little impact on Eau Claire's budget. And that's because we started off on the low end of what we receive for current shared revenue. Among larger communities, Eau Claire and Janesville and Waukesha all receive very little currently for shared revenue on a per capita basis. And because the change is a percent increase over current shared revenue, even if it's a larger percent, like 20%, our increase is also very small. And going forward, because the increase is tied to changes in sales tax, we will continue to see very small increases year over year.
Can you explain the why there, why communities like yours are on the lower end of the 20%?
From my perspective, and I think City Manager Roloff has much more of the long view, but the formula was set back in the past and communities have changed. And so I have studied, I'm interested in data, and I studied the per capita shared revenue for all kinds of communities, and it's tremendously variable. So one larger community has $10 per capita in shared revenue, and on the other end, it's $439 per capita in shared revenue. And some of it seems like it's connected to a lower income community, but some it's not at all connected. And so it's really very disparate. And it's, I think, as I mentioned, I think City Manager Roloff might have more of the history.
Mark, do you want to chime in there?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The City Manager Hirsch points out that there were actually two components to the shared revenue formula years ago that has long since been abandoned. There was a per capita formula portion of it, but there was also a formula called aidable revenues. And aidable revenues was a very complex method, but it took a look at expenditures. And if expenditures were going up, then the assumption was that the community needed it more. So the formula actually benefited the more you spent. On the other hand, there was also a part of the formula that said if you have a low property tax per capita, mm-hmm. that low property value per capita provided you some more benefit as well. But then when they started to really just mess with the formula, they froze everything in time. And so if you happened to be low spending at the time, you were frozen in and not getting a good benefit. Similarly, if your value was high per capita, that didn't help you either. So this freezing in time over the years, towns and smaller communities were actually vying for the per capita formula. Hmm. The per capita may have gotten up in the last changes right around Act 10. So the formula means absolutely nothing. I used to teach a public finance class 25 years ago, and I would go through this formula to try to explain it. Well, it's meaningless now. So to even teach it in a classroom is meaningless because it's based on nothing. So when somebody comes in like City Manager Hirsch and tries to make sense of this, it makes absolutely no sense without that historical perspective.
Well, let's get the view from Anthony Penterman, mayor of Kakana. What are your insights from Kakana?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Speaker Voss, Senator LeMahieu, Senator Federowitz, and Tony Kurtz, Governor Evers, and all the members of Congress who voted for AB 245, the shared revenue. You know, although the one penny is appreciated, I think there's still some discussion that it needs to be had. The city of Kakana is looking to see a 27% increase, so on the higher end. And that equates to about $559,000 for the city of Kakana.
How much of an impact will that make to Kakana residents? How will it be felt in your community?
It'll help. Not a whole lot. You know, over the last 20 years, state aid for critical local services like police, fire, and emergency medical services, you know, has steadily declined in real dollars. While inflation has caused the average prices to increase by over 50%. So the money, like I said, is appreciated, but it'll have minimal impact on us.
As we talk about increasing shared revenue from the state to local communities, we hear from Kakana Mayor Anthony Penterman there. Oshkosh City Manager Mark Roloff is here and Eau Claire City Manager Stephanie Hirsch. You can join the conversation with your question and comment about shared revenue, 800-642-1234. So, Stephanie, the new formula directs money to the most costly municipal programs like police, fire, roads. Are these the areas most in need of additional funding in Eau Claire?
It's not a hardship for us to fund those areas. The main issue is that it's a very small increase. And so basically that increase accounts for the inflationary growth of probably just one or two of our larger departments. So that is where we would spend that funding anyway. Those constraints are not a challenge. And because it's not very much money, it's mm-hmm. easy to spend that amount of money.
Mark Roloff, communities now required to maintain current police staffing levels or risk a cut in state funding. We saw between 2018 and 2019, Oshkosh reduce its police force by 8 officers. Is that raise in state funding worth the additional limits on budget decisions?
Well, I think the stat you probably threw out had to do more with vacancies. Our authorized strength hasn't changed. But I think Stephanie points out something that's similar to all of us. The increase is really going to help cover increased costs for what I call the big three, police, fire, public works. But what it will provide is we've been relying almost entirely on property taxes to cover increased costs over the years, because up until now, the cities, villages, and towns and counties get no cut of the sales tax, no direct cut of the sales tax or income tax. We rely solely on property taxes. So the relief, well, whether it's relatively minor, as Eau Claire is pointing out, or in Oshkosh, which it's still relatively minor, it's going to give property tax relief because we're not going to have to turn to the property tax as our only tool in our financial toolbox.
Mm. Anthony, what is your view on the new requirement to maintain police staffing levels?
You know, like Mark said, you know, the city of Kakana is also relying heavily on property taxes for the three critical services, police, fire, and public works. Right now, those three make up about 49% of our annual budget. This will help just with the basically with the inflationary costs.
I'm going to jump in here with, as we have a panel of city leaders on shared revenue, the increase in state funding for local communities throughout Wisconsin. Kakana's Anthony Penterman, Stephanie Hirsch of Eau Claire is here, and Oshkosh's Mark Roloff. You can add your voice to the discussion. Call in with a question or a concern at 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As communities around the state prepare for increased state funding flowing into their local budgets, we check in with three city leaders on how the shared revenue formula will affect services. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Hirsch is here, Eau Claire City Manager, Anthony Penterman, Mayor of Kakana, and Mark Roloff, City Manager of Oshkosh. Mark, the state funding, the state is funding this new $300 million innovation fund that will award grants to local governments that combine services or duties if the mergers save at least 10% of pre-merger costs. How likely is that incentive to result in mergers and consolidations, cost savings for taxpayers?
Well, yeah, we just had a meeting with some city leaders last week and discussed at length this. You know, we've done a lot of these consolidations of many different sorts throughout the state over the years. So those improvements aren't going to count towards this innovation fund. So I think we're going to, I think some of us talked about looking at a granular level. What small things can we do that we haven't been doing that might be able to take advantage of this? The grant will cover about 25% of the cost. So, and it also requires a demonstrated, and that's yet to be defined, a demonstrated 10% increase or decrease in cost. And there's a lot more to that. But we're going to have to take a look at how the rules ultimately get developed by the state to see how we can take advantage of it. But I think strategically it'll probably happen on a more granular level. When you think about some of the great innovations that have been occurring over the last 30 years, a great example is the North Shore Fire Department in the north suburbs of Milwaukee. It was a great innovation, but they're not going to be able to take advantage of that because they've already done it. We're certainly looking at different possibilities. There's a being discussed the possibility of creating legislation to allow fire districts, which are a little different than what North Shore did. But to the degree we can get additional tools to create more consolidations and provide efficiencies, I think we all want to look at it. But the rules of the program are really going to dictate how much people take advantage of them.
Stephanie Hirsch, where do you see potential opportunities to share facilities or share staff or other overhead?
I echo Manager Roloff's comments that it's an exciting opportunity. That said, the 10%, the requirement for 10% savings will really present a challenge, and it's my guess that will have to be refined. The one of the areas where we are working on consolidation or coordination is in fire services, and to try to put together two departments that are very underfunded right now and then still be able to generate savings is a significant challenge, especially because our more rural fire departments are generally volunteer staffed and they really need to actually invest more in order to have the professional firefighters. So it doesn't seem like we'll be able to reach that 10% savings, but it's my understanding that those rules will get refined probably over time. And this is their first crack at it. But in general, I think it's great to have an innovation fund.
Anthony Penterman, in Kakana as mayor, does consolidation of services make local governments more efficient?
I believe so. About 2 years ago, we combined our EMS. We took on the Village of Combined Locks, so we won't be eligible for those funds. But we are continuing to look to expand our services to our neighboring towns and villages. Right now, we have a $1.75 million ladder truck on order. We could supply those neighboring communities with fire service also and hopefully maybe take advantage of some of that innovation fund money.
So I'm wondering, Mark Roloff, how could the state's funding of local government services be improved in the future? What do you have your eye on?
Well, I think clearly fire consolidation is something to look at, because you take a look throughout the state, whether it's urban areas or rural areas, that challenge remains. And attracting people to fire services is an equal challenge. So I think that providing those regional services, but for example, City of Oshkosh already provides emergency medical services to all but one of our surrounding townships. We even go out to another city and another village about 10 miles away. So that regional approach to providing services just makes so much sense. It is better for the taxpayer, but it's also better for the citizen or the resident who benefits from these services to be more reliable and effective. So I think you're going to see more of that. You know, there's things you can talk about, sharing equipment and things like that. And I think Mayor Penterman points out, you know, something like a ladder truck, which is so capital intensive, having the ability to share that type of equipment makes sense. But at a certain point, it needs to be shared on a larger regional basis so that everybody can take advantage of these types of equipment that can be better used if it's shared.
We're talking about Wisconsin state government setting aside additional money to support local government services, and we're getting reaction from Oshkosh City Manager Mark Roloff. We have Eau Claire City Manager Stephanie Hirsch and Kakana Mayor Anthony Penterman. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Stephanie Hirsch, you know, we went from 2014 to 2021, shared revenue barely grew, according to figures from the Department of Revenue. Are you worried about another long stretch without a boost in funding from the state?
I'm very worried about it, yes. And that was, I guess, what was discouraging for Eau Claire in this whole discussion, is because this was advertised as sort of a once-in-a-generation change or a kind of watershed moment. And for us, it just is such a small drop in the bucket. And so I do think that we as a state need to think about a bigger reform process. I mean, I think we need to think about reform to the formula, but also local communities really need more tools to generate revenue so that it's not all on the property tax. Wisconsin communities right now really only have two tools that they have control over. One is a referendum and the other is a local vehicle registration fee. And Eau Claire passed both of those in the past year. A referendum adding $44 per household and a wheel tax adding $24 per household. In comparison, this increase is an $18 per person. So really all of our pressure just keeps going on property tax, and we need more tools like an optional sales tax and other tools that lots of other states have these available, and we need to do those in Wisconsin. And I just want to point out that even though Eau Claire didn't prosper in this change, it has been really great to be listened to other communities and to understand how so many places are struggling, however they fared in this, the results of this. And they are rural communities that are our neighbors. We need them to succeed for us to succeed, and vice versa. So I'm happy it's happening, and I hope that this becomes the blueprint for more reform and more rapid reform.
Anthony Penterman, will this new formula reduce the number of referendums going to the ballot? What can voters expect?
Well, I hope so. You know, due to inflation, you know, a challenging recruitment and retention environment, property tax fatigue, we need additional support. Like you said, I hope we don't have a long stretch before we get additional funding. You know, we can't continually turn to the property taxpayer to fund these public services. You know, it's just not a long-term solution. So I think there's a lot of talks that need to be had yet, but appreciative of what they did so far.
Well, thank you all for joining us and coming to the table. That was Anthony Penterman, mayor of Kaukauna, Stephanie Hirsch, Eau Claire city manager, and Mark Roloff, Oshkosh city manager. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The balance of power on Wisconsin's Supreme Court swings from conservative to liberal control this week. The 10-year term of Justice Janet Protasiewicz officially starts tomorrow after an April election with record campaign spending. Join the discussion on the state's high court at any point. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ed Miller is here, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Stevens Point, former co-chair for the Redistricting Committee for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Ed, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to be back.
Yes. So, Protasiewicz scheduled to be sworn into office tomorrow onto the bench. How soon could the new liberal majority of the court begin to issue decisions?
Well, it'll be a while. Because for one thing, a number of the cases will have to work their way through the courts. Now, cases can be immediately heard by the Supreme Court. In other words, they can accept the case without going through the district court and the Court of Appeals. But often they let cases go through the full system unless it's something of statewide importance, and then the Supreme Court could take it up directly. But even that would take a while because people would have to file the papers and so forth. So don't expect decisions for a little bit.
Conversely, what could take years to get before the state Supreme Court?
Well, there's a number of cases, and there's other aspects of the court before the cases would be heard. But there's a whole bunch of cases. The most notable ones that people are talking about certainly is the Wisconsin abortion case. And that case in recognizing the abortion law that occurred, and that has already begun in the lower courts. And that would be recognizing Wisconsin's abortion prohibition that was enacted shortly after Wisconsin became a state. And that's one case that people have talked about. Another case certainly is the redistricting case. Wisconsin has one of the most gerrymandered systems in the country. And so you will see that Republicans overwhelmingly dominate the Senate and the Assembly, while if you look at the votes, that the Democrats have either won more votes than the Republicans overall for the state, or it was fairly even in other elections. But the point is that the way the districts are drawn have allowed the Republicans to dominate that. As well as the Congress in terms of the House. In addition to that, those are the two of the top cases. Another case, which would be a pressing case, and that would be one dealing with ballot boxes. And so the Supreme Court has essentially said that we cannot, in Wisconsin, have ballot boxes where people can drop off their absentee ballots. There's been all kinds of fights over that. And that'll be a pressing case, you know, before the next election that they probably will reverse that case. Then there's a whole bunch of others, including allowing people to stay on the court, commissions and boards after their term has expired. Hmm. The court has said that you could stay on it until the new appointee has been confirmed by the Senate. And of course, with the Democratic governor and Republican Senate, they have not been confirming Evers' appointments. And so that is an issue. Anyway, these are some of those, and there are certainly other ones that could be considered.
So what I'm hearing is abortion and voting and election issues, certainly up there as the most pressing issues that may have a place before this court. And, you know, it has been said that the first priority for Democrats will be to bring a case to challenge the legislative maps. Might there be a request even this week for the court to hear a redistricting case?
Right. And they may the case may be filed with the Wisconsin Supreme Court about redistricting. Now, Wisconsin Supreme Court has had all kinds of problems with redistricting and when it's going to the court. And in almost all cases of going back to the 1930s, the Wisconsin court had one that the legislature has not been able to handle it. And in most cases, with 1960 redistricting an exception, they've been handled by the federal court rather than the state court. And it was for that reason that the state court wanted to have a procedure that if it came to them, how could they draw the districts? And that was the redistricting committee that you mentioned that I co-chaired, came up with a plan at that time. But that's a real problem for the court to be able to do it because they don't really have a mechanism to redraw the districts.
We're talking about the balance of power shift on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Ed Miller, our guest, former political science professor, served as co-chair for the Wisconsin Supreme Court Redistricting Committee. You can join the conversation, your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Ed, you touched on this briefly, but how likely is the Supreme Court to take up cases without lower court reviews in order, you know, to speed up its rulings?
Right. And there's been pressure for them to do that. But the court has backtracked on that, that they want to see what the rulings are of the lower courts, especially the Court of Appeals that we now have. I mean, at one time we didn't have a Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, but we have since the late 70s, and to see what they have done. So certain cases may go back to the courts. Now, the redistricting case, they may not, only because, one, it's of statewide importance, and second, they've already heard a redistricting case and decided it previously. So they may take that up earlier. But let me just note, one of the things that will be changing in the court is who is the chief. And that's an interesting issue because Wisconsin had a situation in which it was pretty neutral. It was that individual who served on the court the longest became the Chief Justice. So this is not like the U.S. Supreme Court. It was done based upon seniority on the court. But when the conservatives got a majority on the court, there was a great pressure to oust the current person, and that was Shirley Abrahamson, from the Chief Justice. And she had been Chief Justice for some time. She was originally appointed to the court. When there's a vacancy in the court, the governor gets to appoint some way to the court until the next election. She was appointed by Governor Lucy, and that's how far back it went. And she became the Chief Justice of the court. Well, the conservatives wanted to oust her as Chief Justice. And so what they did was they pressed in the legislature a constitutional amendment to change that. And they did change it. The citizens did vote for it. I think many of them didn't know what they were voting for based upon the complexity of the situation. But the fact is they did approve it. So the justices now picked their own chief. And that immediately changed once the constitutional amendment was adopted. It was changed from Shirley Abrahamson, who was a liberal, to a conservative, and that's Rokensack. Mm-hmm. And she's the one that's retiring. And she became the Chief Justice after that. And she served for a number of years, and now it's Ziegler. Justice Ziegler is the chief conservative. Well, that will switch.
With the Chief Justice, then, how much gatekeeping is it? What do they get to do versus the other justices? How important is that?
Well, the chief is, you know, as they say, you know, one among equals. But the chief has other things. She's the one who presides over the sessions. She presides over the conferences. And she also presides over the court system, essentially. And so the chief is pretty important. And the chief, with the majority, you know, in the same ideological bent, could also be involved in changing the rules of the court. And most notably, Shirley Abrahamson was pressing for an open court. So in other words, when they had conferences, now we're not talking about cases, but when they had conferences, not to discuss cases, but other kinds of rules, Shirley Abrahamson insisted that they be open, and they were covered by Wisconsin Eye, for example, so the citizens could see what was going on. When the conservatives took over as the majority, they reversed those rules. And so with a majority as liberal and a chief justice who is liberal, I wouldn't be surprised if they went back to some of the earlier rules, which were more open. Another key rule I should mention that may be adopted is the recusal rule. And so what happened was in the federal courts determined that individual justices of courts who got a lot of money, for example, from certain interest groups, had to recuse themselves from the cases. In other words, they couldn't participate in those particular cases. And that came out of a case in West Virginia. However, it came up in the Wisconsin Supreme Court of whether they would adopt a rule requiring justices not to participate in cases in which they received a lot of money, which, of course, could mean that they're biased, and they turned that down. The liberals favored a recusal rule, and the conservatives were against it. So it's possible that there could be a recusal rule adopted, and there's been a number of cases in which this has come up of whether justices should have not participated in the case, most notably when Gableman was on the court. He received a ton of work from a law firm. And that the argument was he received this work without paying for it. So in effect, it was contributions, and that he should not have participated in cases involving that particular law firm. Well, he did. And that's been an issue.
Insights there from UW-Stevens Point Emeritus Political Science Professor Ed Miller as we discuss consequential topics that could come before the state Supreme Court. You can join the conversation about state politics along the way. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Judge Jana Protasiewicz is seated on the 7-member Wisconsin Supreme Court this week, we explore what a majority liberal-controlled court may prioritize and what to watch for in coming months, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. UW-Stevens Point Emeritus Political Science Professor Ed Miller is our guide. Let's take a call now. Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi. What would you like to add?
Yes, good morning. I was wondering if the guest sees any possibility of going back to some of our environmental protections, for example, groundwater protections. There's a big problem in the central part of the state with residential wells contaminated with nitrate from industrial agriculture, and we've seen a lot of a real loosening of the protections from high-capacity wells. I think that's a result of a court case within the last 10 years. Does the guest see any chance of going back and readdressing some of those environmental issues now with the change in the Supreme Court.
Jeff, thank you. Ed Miller.
Yes, a number of those issues could come for the court, although the court will probably limit the number of ones that they actually reverse. And one of the reasons for this, one is reason certainly time, but a second reason is that in 2 years, there will be another election to the court. And the liberal justice from Wausau, Ann Walsh Bradley, she will be up. And so that will also be a major battle. So all these particular issues, if they reverse too many, could be used in that campaign. And I'm sure that that will be a very, just like the one we just had, it's very expensive campaign. She will be up for election. So if she loses to a conservative, for example, then the court then reverses 4-3 the other way. So anyway, yes, the answer is yes, they could take them up, but they've got a number of issues to take up. And it's an important issue, clearly.
Jeff, thank you. Turning to one of those high priority issues that we have seen being posed for the court, you mentioned abortion and a challenge to Wisconsin's 1849 ban on abortion is working its way through the court system now, challenged by Attorney General Josh Call. So with this new liberal majority, what are the chances the state's abortion ban could be overturned?
I think it's pretty good. For one thing is that the Prozac, she discussed that in her campaign. Now, that's always been a particular issue about discussing various potential cases before the court. And for many years, people who ran to be justice of Supreme Courts all over the country didn't mention cases. In other words, they're pretty neutral because they say, oh, a case will be before them. But that has been changing not only in Wisconsin. And she particularly made some mention of the abortion issue as well as the redistricting issue. Those are two of the issues that she addressed in the campaign. Anyway, so the bottom line is, if that comes before the court, I think that will be reversed. And so Wisconsin's got it complicated because Wisconsin has a later case on abortion, which is certainly more liberal than the earlier case, both of which, of course, had been suspended because of Roe versus Wade. So, but there's a whole, and there's also the issue of even interpreting the earlier case. What does it actually mean? And different interpretations have now been submitted to the lower court. Anyway, so Wisconsin right now bans abortion based upon the previous cases, but that's likely to change.
Would it be possible? Might conservative justices join a decision overturning the ban?
It's possible. The main one is Brian Hagendorf. And he has, even though he's conservative and elected with support of conservatives, the fact is he has joined the liberals in some cases. And so he's been more like the swing justice over the last few years.
Hagedorn, as you mentioned, becoming a swing justice in recent years. With the court's new majority, who appears most likely to become the swing vote on split rulings?
Well, he would be most likely the swing vote in the rulings. And the person who's likely to be the chief, who will be very significant, interestingly enough, at least I think maybe, is Ann Walsh Bradley. I think she may be the chief justice. She may be voted as the chief justice, which is significant. Also, she's up for re-election, as I said, in the next election. So I think if you look over the years in Wisconsin, the court has become much more polarized than it ever was before. I mean, there's been all kinds of issues in which there's been disputes. One of the main ones I thought was interesting had to do with money, public money, going to private parochial schools, going to religious schools. The Constitution pretty much says that money shouldn't go to parochial schools. It says that right directly, the almost word for word in the Constitution. Well, the conservative majority then interpreted this that they could go to schools. And of course, religious schools in Wisconsin do receive money to this day. But that in latter times has led to a very polarized court from then on.
Ed Miller, retired political science professor, as we talk about the balance of power changing on Wisconsin's Supreme Court, and you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Ed, since 2015, the Supreme Court justices selected Patience Rogensack to serve as the court's chief justice, as we talked about. And, you know, today officially marks the last day of her 10-year term. What is her legacy on the court?
Well, she has, led the court in the conservative direction, certainly, in the court. And she stepped down because she's currently, I think she's 83 now, and Ziegler has taken over for her. But I think mainly leading the court in a more conservative direction would be her legacy. The court also over the years, I mean, not only with her, but over the years, have been taking fewer cases, which is interesting. It's also true of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, one of the big changes, of course, was the adoption of the Intermediate Court of Appeals in 78. But even later than that, the court has been accepting fewer cases.
And why these do you tend think that be, is?
It's hard to say. There's been a lot of speculation of why all these courts have. Well, one is they don't have to accept any case. So now they do not have to accept any case. At one time, they did because they were the only court of appeal, the only place to take an appeal. But now they don't. So it allows them to take the hope high profile cases, one that affects the state more. And what they've done is taken cases, particularly those cases that involve very ideological matters. You know, a lot of people look at the courts and they see them as neutral arbitrators. Well, they're not. Especially the Supreme Courts, not only Wisconsin, but other Supreme Courts, they are a political body. And you can see this by the ideology, division on the court. Cases, there's often more than one precedent. They can overturn precedents. We recently seen with Roe versus Wade nationally. Facts are rarely the same one case and in another case. So in effect, there are political bodies. And in Wisconsin, we elect our justices.
And Ed, we are out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
Ed Miller, retired UW Stevens Point professor of political science. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.